right, we're hot. Welcome to D's Practice Pod. We're in studio today with a guest. We have Mr. Lee Finkelstein, famous for the Funk Philharmonic and also the original Blues Brothers Band.
Yeah.
So we're very excited to have you in here today, sir.
Thanks for having me.
What
a great studio you have here, man. It's like
thank
a
you,
kid
thank
in a candy
you.
Store. This is great.
So, let's get right into it.
Sure.
Firstly, where are you from originally?
Right here in Hicksville. Well, started out in Sunnyside, Queens, and that's actually where I had my first drum lessons. I can, if you care to hear the story.
I want to hear everything you have to say.
So, well, going back even further, my father, as a young child, grew up in East New York. And he loved music, and he loved the drums, and he made his own drum set out of old tin cans and when they used to have rubber inner tubes.
Right.
And he kept it on the roof of their house in East New York, and he would run home from school every day and run up on the roof and play his drum set, his homemade drum set.
Wow.
And then as soon as he was old enough, he went to work in my grandfather's sweatshop in the garment district, and that was pretty much it for the drums. He ended up, you know, going to the military and school and worked for the city. But all it was, he and my mom were great dancers, and they loved music. There was always big band music and Latin music and playing in the house. They were great mambo dancers. So I was 5 years old, and like every five-year-old, you know, banging on stuff. But
right.
My father, who, you know, could hear something, thought he heard something in my banging. And the guy across the hall from us in Sunnyside, Bernie Spiegel was his name, also worked in the garment district at the time, but he was a weekend warrior doing club dates and weddings and parties and stuff. And my father said, Bernie, you know, come over and tell me if my son has anything. And Bernie came over with sticks and a pad when I was five and showed me singles, doubles, you know, paradiddles, like very, very basic rudiments.
Rudimentary rudiments.
Yeah, yeah. So I kind of started then. And, you know, and it was, you know, it was like an occasional lesson with him, but I was always bang on something. And then we moved out to Hicksville in fourth grade, Fork Lane Music, Mr. Eisenhower, Mr. E, what instrument do you want to play? I said the drums, and they said, well, what about, you know, a second choice? And I was like, oh, I don't know, trumpet, whatever. It didn't
right.
matter to me. I wanted to play the drums.
Right.
Everyone wanted to play the drums.
That's
and when the,
way it
when
is.
The letters came
right.
back to the parents and said, oh, your son is going to play trumpet. And my mother called the school and said, you don't understand. My son has to play the drums. And so, there, you know, there was band, orchestra, and chorus
right.
throughout elementary school. And then actually both my brothers followed on drums, Stephen Finkelstein and Eric. And when Eric graduated sixth grade, Mr. E., at Eric's graduation, he said, what am I going to do now? No more Finkelsteins, because
right.
there was a Finkelstein drummer
right.
in the
it was like
the,
that with
for
my
the next,
family, too.
For like
yeah.
the next 9 years.
Right.
And then through junior high, and then I, you know, started doing gigs in high school 5 nights a week and
wow.
Never looked back.
Wow. Yeah, that's fantastic.
A brief synopsis of the story.
What gave you that bug? I mean, your dad obviously was an influence. But
yeah.
what personally for you made you want to do it?
I mean, it was, you know, my parents were really into the mambo and the Latin stuff, a lot of percussion. And it moved me.
That was during the first Latin invasion with the Cubans and stuff,
like
probably, right?
Yeah, in the 50s. They were, right, you know, they were great mambo dancers.
Right. Anybody that listens to I Love Lucy would know all about that.
Exactly.
Right. Okay.
So they were playing. There was always music in the house. If that wasn't playing, it was my dad used to cut out of school and go see the big bands uptown in Harlem.
Right.
And,
mm-hmm.
and so it was big band music. And if it wasn't that, it was like my mom would play the Broadway soundtracks, you know, so I knew all those and,
right.
you know, and listening to that. And then, of course, you know, Ringo and the Beatles and rock and roll came into, you know, prominence. And, of course, everyone wanted to be Ringo. Everyone wanted the Ludwig kit and, you know.
I don't think I've interviewed anyone
yeah.
who hasn't mentioned the Beatles.
Yeah, I mean, if you're of that age, how could you not?
Right.
Yeah. And then, it's 50 years ago, right. 1969, Led Zeppelin II came out, Tommy, Blind Faith, and those were, you know, Cream was a little before that, and those were like the weaning, the amazing records. And then my dad again came home, a friend of his belonged to the record, Columbia Record Club or whatever it was. And
yeah,
they'd right, send you like the, you know, the flavor of the month, the album of the month. And it was this, it was a Charles Mingus record.
Okay.
And he said, his friend said, maybe your son will like this. It's not my cup of tea. And I heard Danny Richman play on the drums. And I said, that's what I want to do. I heard the jazz thing and I just, you know, and I loved it. Danny just had a swing that moved me. And then I went gung-ho into jazz land.
Right.
I actually I was a little closed-minded at the time, so to speak. And I was like, oh, no, the rock and roll, it's, you know, I became kind of a jazz snob.
Right.
I missed out on a lot of good rock and roll because I kind of turned my nose up to it, unfortunately. Now I, like, someone calls a tune, I'm like, no, I don't know that tune. They're like, what do you mean you don't know? That's what you grew up with.
Right.
You know, so, you know, I kick myself for that sometimes. But it's still, so I'm still learning, which is great, you know.
That's funny. My dad was like, he joined the Marines just before the Vietnam thing kind of broke off. And so that meant he was in high school during the birth of rock and roll, and he wanted nothing to do with it.
Wow.
He was a classically trained pianist, and that's what he was going to do when he went into the Marines. At least he thought so. He wanted to be part of the concert band there.
Yeah.
You know?
That was a good gig.
Yeah, but they make you take an aptitude test. And what they really needed at the time was tank mechanics. And as soon as they found out that he was mechanically inclined,
so from
they didn't need too many piano players. Sure needed tank mechanics, yeah. So he went to sniper school. He went to officer candidate school. He did a lot of different things. And he wound up spending about 4 years in there, but it made an indelible mark on him, you know, which to this day, you know. You make some bed, and you got to be able to drop a quarter off that thing. You know?
Right.
But
well, that's once a Marine.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Semper Fi. You're in there.
Bless him.
That's pretty
much it. Thank you, Marines.
Yes, absolutely. That's actually the reason why I didn't join after school, though, is because firstly, if you're one of your parents is military, you get birthday cards. As soon as you turn 18, they want you.
Right,
you know?
Come on.
So
it's in the blood.
He staved off
right.
all of the recruiters and everything else and said, no, we're not doing that.
Wow.
You know, so, because, you know, he saw some things. He didn't actually go into Vietnam because
that's good.
The Marines didn't send tanks over there. The Army did. So they didn't. And fortunately, he was actually out just before the skirmish really started. But they could have called him back because you're in active reserve for, I think, 2 years afterwards.
Right.
You know? But, that's, you know. All right. Important teachers.
Well, of course, my first teacher, Bernie Spiegel, and then at Fort Wayne School was Mr. Eisenhower, who, that was 4th, 5th, 6th grade. I was in the band, orchestra, and chorus. And then I studied privately with Howie Mann. Henry Gates was a great drum teacher at Hicksville Junior High School. The F. Arden and Burt School of Music. I took some private lessons there. Skip Scott, another Hicksville great drummer, really opened me up to the jazz thing because he had the whole Lenny Tristano method of teaching. And then I took a lesson or two with Kenwood Dennard, Adam Nussbaum. Later on, I went to SUNY at Old Westbury, where I studied with Warren Smith, and he introduced me to Charlie Persip, who I took a few lessons with, and Ken McIntyre, who ran the music department at Old Westbury, was also very important. teacher, not a drummer necessarily, but a great musician. I actually at 14, you had to be 16 to get into this orchestra, but I auditioned at 14. It was the Nassau County Symphony Orchestra. We used to rehearse down in Lido Beach at the Cabana. I got into that at 14 and played concerts all over the Nassau County Park System, which was quite an education. 12th grade in high school, I started playing five nights a week with a band called Hadrian Decree. They were all older than me out of high school. There was an ad in the Penny Saver looking for drummers. And my father said, hey, go audition, you know. And right. I went there. They liked me. And I was still in high school. I was still 17. You know, he had to be 18 to play in the clubs, but I was playing in the clubs five nights a week. And that's, I really learned a lot doing that. Just a quick little story with that. We used to do a Thursday night. It was late. And after you'd gigged on Thursday night, you went to Howard Johnson's afterwards. So I would always miss my Friday first period history class.
Oh, boy.
And one day the teacher says to me, Finkelstein, what's the deal? How come you never here on Friday? Mr. Sklars was his name. He was like a drill sergeant.
Right.
And I said, Mr. Sklars, I'm not going to lie to you. You know, I'm playing in a band. I do gigs every Thursday. I don't get home till 4:30 or 5 in the morning. I said, I can't wake up on Friday. And he said to me, playing music, huh? He said, you know, I failed Billy Joel, too.
Oh, boy.
So there's my Billy Joel story.
That's funny.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Which actually, Billy lived behind my best friend, and the Hassels used to practice there in his carport. So, you know,
That was around where? I imagine it's somewhere near
Fork Lane School, Meeting Lane, like between Newbridge and Jerusalem, behind
right.
Holy Trinity.
Where, like, the Village Green.
Yeah, they're hanging out at the Village
exactly,
Green.
Exactly, right.
Which we hung out at the Village
yeah.
Green. Oh, yeah.
which do you think is what he considers the Parkway Diner? Do you think it's the Broadway up on 107 up there?
I have no
there?
Idea. I think it's, you know, a lot of times, because I know Becker and Fagan from Steely Dan do this as well.
Right.
Sometimes it's not accurate or it's made up.
Right,
it
yeah,
just,
yeah, yeah.
It's mm-hmm. You know, it sounds good.
Right, yeah.
Parkway Diner instead
right.
of the Broadway Diner or, you know.
Right. Well, the Broadway Diner is right by
right,
the Parkway.
Right, right. Yeah,
so,
exactly.
You know.
So it could be.
Yeah. Because
I don't think it was ever called the Parkway Diner. I don't know of a...
Well, I could tell you one thing. Years ago, I was also in business with my family. We had a bottled water distributorship. And one of our customers was Billy Joel's entire management team. We had their houses.
Uh-huh.
It's really weird to see, like, stenciled on a calzone case in someone's garage, property of Billy Joel.
Oh,
right?
Wow.
So I had all
That's
of their...
Great.
And I can tell you exactly where their office used to be. It was right by that diner, actually. There is a... Just before you hit the Parkway, there is a yellow brick and black granite office building.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I know exactly what
that's
you're talking
the building.
About.
They had the basement,
oh,
and
wow.
at least one of the other floors there, and that's where he conducted his business. They had the root beer rag newsletter running out of there, and
right.
everything, right? Just basically across from what used to be Pathmark. Now it's
yeah,
H-Mark.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah,
right,
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 right. Yeah, but yeah,
Dixville, baby.
Yeah, yeah. Hometown stuff. Let's see. Drumming influences as a drummer, who really sparks it?
Whoo, that's it's
loaded,
a really long list.
Right.
Like when people say, "Who's your favorite drummer?"
Yeah, it's
and
a
I
tough
say
question.
To them, "You got a month because yeah. it's just you know it's every genre that I can think of."
Right,
but it's you know it's Ringo and Charlie Watts, the early guys, and then there was Ginger Baker. Mitch Mitchell was one of my idols. Loved Keith Moon. And then, like, the guys that weren't household names, there were a lot of drummers I dug. I mean, I you know, the Allman Brothers, both
right.
Butch and J-Mo, just, you know, major influence. Bill Kreutzmann, Mickey Hart from the Grateful Dead, I loved that stuff. But Ainsley Dunbar.
Yeah.
You know, I saw him with Frank Zappa, and that's, he's like in my top five. He is just one of those guys. But then there's guys like Sammy Piazza, who you mentioned too, and people like never heard of him. And he played for a short time with Hot Tuna with Jack and Yorba. Right. And he was their Ringo. He just played the music. And I really, as much as I enjoyed all those guys, and then, of course, you know, later on was Tony Williams and Billy Cobham and the you know, the whole fusion thing.
Right.
But you know, on the other side of the coin, when I got into Danny Richmond, I got into jazz, and then I heard Elvin and Roy and Max, and, you know, I can go on with that list. Mm-hmm. And then the newer guys, Jack DeJohnette, and, you know, it's the, I can name names forever.
Right. I'm the same way.
Right.
You know, it's such a loaded question, but if you're going to have a podcast about it, there has to be that question, but everybody comes up with a different answer.
Yeah, because like the generational thing, because I remember this was like in the early 80s, and I had never listened to Rush or Neil Peart.
Right.
And he was the guy, and because I was listening, I was like, no, it's jazz, man. You know, I got to listen to jazz. And or the fusion stuff. So I was kind of copying Billy Cobham and Alphonse Moussant and the fusion guys.
Right.
And I remember this guy, you know, a drummer, obviously. He came to a gig I was doing and came up to me after the set. And he said, man, I love all those Neil Peart licks you're doing. And I was like, well, that's nice. But, you know, I've never really listened to Neil Peart. I said, you know, I'm emulating. It's more Billy Cobham and that kind of thing. So it's like, you know, having the same roots as Neil, kind of thing, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, that you, that's where it led you to.
Yeah, he was to me the guy that in my early days sort of changed the game, because I was listening to, well, first I started off with Kiss, and that's not real heavy lifting,
right?
You know,
right. Yeah.
Then I got into bands like the Police, where there was a little bit of a reggae thing in there along with the other stuff.
And Stuart Copeland he changed the game too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I never really listened to them either. It just, you know, it was kind of too new wavy for me, I guess it was. But he did. He had that cool reggae thing, you know.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, you can't forget John Bonham.
You
know,
and that's just, pioneer.
You know, he changed the game. Still.
Yeah.
You there's a handful of those guys that just untouchable.
Agreed. Yeah. I once was at a clinic when Five Towns College was still running out of that old Seaford High School.
Right.
And they had a drummer's night there, and one of the guys that was one of the first acts that played was Michael Shreve. You know, and it was, you know, we're watching these other guys, and of course you had. Apice was up there,
right.
And Dean Castronova, so the guys with the bigger kits and everything.
Yeah,
And Michael Shreve, I didn't realize, he sat literally right behind me, because this is what the drummer world really is people that, you know, it's not just an ego thing. It's a love for what it is that you do. And this guy, since he was one of the first guys playing, knew he'd had the opportunity to sit down and actually see the show, and you don't always get a chance to do that,
right?
You know? But so I didn't even bother saying it to him, because he was so enthralled with just watching what was going on. I'm like, well, I'm going to bother this guy? Let him enjoy his day,
sure.
You know?
And what? I mean, what was he like? 16 at Woodstock or something?
Crazy young, yeah. But and another one of those iconic solos, because now that's part of the movie.
Oh, totally.
You know, and you know, for all times, that's you know, he doesn't have to do anything else. It's there.
Exactly. Well, going back to that, then there was, like, the first band I played in was, I think, Ron Bush was his name, from Iron Butterfly, Inagata DeVita drum solo. You know, it was like Wipeout. Like, if you were a drummer, you had to play Wipeout. You had to play that Inagata DeVita solo, you know.
I went to, what's his name, the producer of that Iron Butterfly album. I went to his house. And
Here in Westbury.
Yeah, on Plainfield Road, right near where the parkway is.
I
helped, because Jerry Rickey asked me.
Don Casale?
Don Casale, yeah.
I did some sessions there back in the...
Yeah, I didn't do any sessions there. I helped him move a piano. Because, you know, as soon as they need a piece of meat, you know, they give me a call.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah, I don't know what happened with that piano. It was like a baby grand that, oh, this thing was beat to snot. But nobody wanted to throw it out. So for a while at the Drum Center, when they were in Plainview and they actually took most of the strip,
yeah,
it was sitting in the warehouse over there for like on its up and down this way, like an album.
Right, you
know?
Nice.
But I don't know what happened with it, but I'm pretty sure it just met with a dumpster at
some
point. They
made a planter out of it.
Exactly. Right. Let's see. How about musical influences other than drummers that influence your playing as a drummer?
Yeah, other than drummers. That's kind of an endless list as well, because there were so many. Like I said, growing up, listening to like Broadway soundtracks,
yes,
and then, you know, Count Basie and Duke Ellington, the big bands that that my father used to listen to. But then, you know, when I got into the jazz thing, Charles Mingus became such a force in my vocabulary and just my being. And then I went extreme, you know, extreme. Thelonious Monk and John Coltrane and the jazz guys. You know, and on the rock and roll side, Clapton and Jack Bruce, the Blind Faith, Steve Winwood, Grateful Dead, Allman Brothers, that music made a really, really big impact on, you know, what I...
Yeah, fixed, yeah.
You know,
I mean,
you
just mentioned
emulate.
A long span of time, but not only a long span of time, but a wide variety of styles.
Skip Scott, who I mentioned earlier, was almost raised by Lenny, but was studying with Lenny, and he's the one that taught me that Lenny Tristano method.
Yeah,
and coming from that, and actually I have to mention... Lenny Tristano, who was kind of a stepfather to some really good friends of mine, and later on, well, it was like 70s, I was introduced to the Lenny Tristano method of teaching, and he taught drums. You would keep like straight jazz time and then play, you would learn all the Charlie Parker heads, the bebop heads, and play those with your left
interdependently,
hand.
Interdependently, right. Like the Al Miller thing with the book one.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then around the drums melodically, while still keeping a ding, ding, da, ding, ding, ding.
Right.
You know, two and four on the
mm-hmm.
hi-hat. So what I did, because I was into rock and roll and the Allman Brothers and other music like that, and I knew those records like the back of my hand, I would take Dwayne Allman solos and start playing them under jazz time, maybe in a,
right.
even like a complete other time signature, like a polyrhythmic thing, just to completely open up the independence thing, an abstract kind of thing. And I'd put on the Allman Brothers at the Fillmore East, and
right.
I'd play like swing time to the tunes, and play to the solos on that, memorize those, and then melodically around the drums. And it wasn't, so it wasn't just bing, 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 jazz world.
Right.
It was like, wow, now I'm playing, you know, Southern rock or you know,
right.
or rock and roll solos.
Right.
And I would do that with rock and roll tunes as well, apply them to like a jazz kind of method.
Right. Well, there's plenty of shuffle in rock and roll, too.
Right, right.
So.
Or just try and take the rock and roll and take it out of the rock and roll, quote-unquote, context, and play it melodically on
right.
the drums. And just, you know, try and develop like as much out of the box and as much technique as I could.
Right.
So when I got to the gig, I could forget all that
yeah.
and try and play time and make everybody happy.
Yeah.
Keep the
yeah.
groove.
There's,
you know.
There's a, oh, who was it? There's a, Thomas Lang.
Yeah, yeah.
He says, well, the reason why you do the really hard things is that it makes it easier to do the easy things when you have to do it. The ease of play, you know, so that instead of it just being, well, I just need to impress everybody with all of this stuff that I can do,
exactly.
as opposed to what the music wants, and knowing that you have that at your beck and call.
Yeah, Yeah, know? I always looked at it as like, you know, get as much vocabulary as you can.
Right.
Because if you get into a conversation with an intellectual, you know, I'm using metaphors here.
Yeah.
You want to be able to carry on a conversation, sure. dialogue with them.
Can't so use just all that, four-letter
right,
words.
Yeah, right. So to have that vocabulary and know when to use
exactly.
it is the thing.
Right.
And that's the thing with technique and the chops. I mean, work on that and hone it and make it yours.
Right.
And then when you get to the gig, if you need it,
right.
you have it.
Yeah, for the it's most a toolbox.
Part, yeah, right. For the most part, lay it down, make it easy for everyone to play, create that pocket
right.
so they don't have to count, they don't have to think. And then when they turn around to you and they go, okay, go.
Now it's, yeah, that's give the drummer some.
Okay,
yeah.
okay, here's my one-handed antics. Look what I could do with my left foot while I'm winking. You right. know, whatever, which is
sure.
great. That's another
thing. Well, a bit of showmanship. You, yeah, you no, have no. to have that too,
no,
sure.
No, that's part of it right. also, because people, it's a physical thing. People expect that. They want to see, you know, I never twirl, but I can do some, you know, some one-handed
right.
stuff. It's like, you know, and you know, you have drummers checking it out, like, wow, you know, what was that? Which
yeah.
is nice when drummers come up to you and say, that thing you were doing, what was that?
Yes,
like,
what was
it? I have no
then
idea.
You got to remember because you've been doing
right.
it for so long.
Exactly.
It's just in second nature.
Right. Or it was that thing that just, that happened.
In the
that,
moment.
In the moment that, you know, then you do it again and it
right.
sounded intentional.
Yeah.
Or you try and capitalize.
It's funny. You mentioned the stick twirling thing. I never really had learned how to do it well because my concept was it doesn't record very well. But
right, doesn't
but
sound
now
right.
with YouTube.
Well, yeah.
Oh, my
There's
gosh.
So much,
it,
so
like, it's
visual.
A brand new
yeah.
world with
yeah.
all of this other stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, you got guys like.
Well, and there are drummers like that, you know, you go to see for that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, this Dylan Elise. You ever heard of this kid?
I know Dylan. Well, because I
yeah.
I played with Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and I,
right.
And when
there you go.
When Dylan got that gig, they said, "Man, you got to hear this kid. You got to
yeah.
hear this guy." And I was like, and then I heard him. It's like
there,
it's scary. He's,
there's a series
you know, crazy.
Of videos from, of him just playing. I guess I think it's somewhere
it's from New
like
Zealand.
In New Orleans
yeah.
or something like that,
yeah.
or someplace like that, just sitting on the street and playing, and you know
yeah.
all of the stick stuff, and you know.
Yeah, and then there's guys like that I have this kind of there are drummers, and there are drumists.
Right. Okay.
And the drumists are like the guys we go see in clinic that look what they did with their left foot while doing
right.
other things. And the drummers are like the accompanists and the guys that are really playing the music and, you know, and play
right.
it for what it's worth. Not for the acrobatics.
Right.
So
yeah, well, there are guys that are almost solely clinicians.
Right, right.
Because there's no other
right.
place to put what
exactly.
it is that they're doing.
And
there's no music written for
yeah.
it.
And who doesn't love that?
Of
you
course.
Know what I mean?
Well, that's
right.
our thing, you know?
But they're not going to go play with a, you know, a four-piece rock band. They just, you know, it's not going to
no,
work.
No, because they're barely going to be able to contain themselves.
Exactly.
You know? Plus...
Right. And there's a place for everything, yeah.
Right, but
yeah.
people that don't know... drums are going to be bored to tears because to them it's just a lot of notes. They don't realize exactly what they're listening to.
Right.
You
I
know, this guy's splitting atoms.
I can't
you
dance
know.
To it.
Right.
And that's, you know.
Then that, yeah.
If
that's,
you're not.
That's
if,
it.
If you're not dancing, if they're not dancing, then it's not happening.
Well, you know what? Know your audience.
Well, yeah. If
you know?
It's a listening thing.
Right.
And yeah. And it's an esoteric.
And if you're playing in front of a bunch of drummers who are all seasoned guys, have at it. Do whatever, you know?
Right.
But no, when the head's not doing like this, they're doing like this.
Yeah.
you
right. Well,
know.
That's the, you know,
right.
like they said, why is the question?
Right.
That, you know, that's the most important question. Because it's like, yeah, why? Oh, because I could fit that 13-note figure in the fill. Yeah, but. Why?
I got
like that. Like that video. I'm sure you've
yeah.
seen it. The guy. This is how you play in 13/8. Don't play in 13/8.
Well, unless you're Vinny.
Well, yeah.
If you're Vinny,
and,
then
well,
you can play.
Yeah. And
yeah.
right. And that's again. There are some guys that do that, and it's dancing,
and it's
swinging, and it's ridiculous.
He has an interesting way of approaching odd time. He does it in two measured chunks. An odd plus an odd is an even. So if he does something in 7/8, or you heard that, have you ever heard the song Cry by, it's a country act, what's it, Faith Hill. That's
him
on that.
And it's Vinny?
That's Vinny.
Yeah.
You know, Just listen to that real subtle difference. Everybody else would have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, right? So he moved the snare over one note, and that's why he gets hired to do that stuff, is because something just that simple makes such a big difference.
Right.
You know? And the only people that are even recognizing that even happened, though, are the people that really know.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's
an intangible to everybody else.
It's just so musical. It's so right. Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard stories about that guy too. Like when the first Buddy Rich Memorial Scholarship, the one in Westbury Music Fair. When the Drum Center was hosting it. At the time, Phase One Studios in Farmingdale had a satellite joint right across. When they were on Charles Court.
Yeah, I remember Phase.
Right?
Yeah.
Right. And they rented the whole place out for all of the acts to practice, you know. And from what I hear, he was in there for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours, because this was a guy, super, super dedicated player.
Perfectionist, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the reasons why he was so nervous is because Gad was his guy. And he knew he was going to be on stage directly next to the man.
That'll do it.
That'll do it.
I've been there.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. Just a funny side note, Gad story. With the Blues Brothers, we go to Soviet Georgia. It's you flying, you know, all through the night, 20 hours, whatever. You know, we finally get there. And it was this Georgia, a jazz festival was going over days.
Right.
And we get there, I look up at the poster, and who is opening for the Blues Brothers, L'Image, which is Steve Gadd, Warren Bernhardt, and Mike Mineri. And they were like a 70s Woodstock kind of groovy kind of jazz. So I was like, I look at this poster, I was like, wait a minute, Steve Gadd is in the band opening for the band I'm playing. I was like, and the Blues Brothers guys, they're all friends. They know Gadd very, very well. And that was the first time I met him, and backstage, and he said, "Oh yeah, I gotta come listen to you." And and we go up and play, and I couldn't see on the side of the stage, like if he was standing, if he was listening. And then I would play a certain thing and go, "Oh wait a minute, that's his." And then I start playing another thing.
Well,
oh, wait
everybody
a minute.
Can say
wait
that.
A minute. Wait a minute, that's his too. He probably left already.
Oh my God,
because that's what it is.
Yeah, I remember years ago, it was at East Meadow High School. No, East Meadow. It was definitely, maybe it was Clark High School. They did he was about ready to basically retire from doing any sort of clinics or anything like that. Huh. I don't know whether he actually did, but they were billing it as, this is probably his last one.
Oh, wow.
And someone asked him a question. It was probably about 50 ways. Because more often than not, it's about 50 ways, right? And, so this kid asked a question about, like, a very specific measure or something like that, you know? Like, he's going to remember these things, right?
Right.
Well, he didn't. And he literally said, well, could you come up here and play?
And show me. Right. <You know? laughs> That's perfect. Right.
Funny.
Yeah, because think about how many records, you know, how many recordings he did. Yeah, can you play that?
Him, Vinny, Bernard Purdy, these guys... you just look at their discography, and it goes for pages, you know?
Yep.
It's insane, you know? Yeah. Pages, they do more in a year than most people do, like, in their entire career.
Of greatness, of just, you know, landmark stuff. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Things that we can only aspire to do.
Well, now I've gotten to know Steve a little bit, and I know Bernard pretty well, and it's just being in their presence, it's like, you know
what it is,
It's so special. Yeah. Bernard lived close to me in Jersey, and he would occasionally show up at gigs. I remember the first time, I was like, hey, do you mind if Purdy sits in? I was like, are you kidding? Bernard Purdy's going to sit down on my drum set? I sat right next to him. It's like, you know, because it's just, it's genius what he does on the drums. Just brilliant.
It's been worked out. He knows exactly what to do, you know. And it's like if you look at like a really amazing painting and you're like, you're looking at it from stroke to stroke, you're like, I could probably do that. No, you can't. You can't. Yeah. But that's the, that's real genius. Well, when you make it look that easy.
You can
like
imitate
you could just,
it.
Sure.
But you can't do it. No. It's the same thing. You know, I was honored. I got the call. I've had Funk Philharmonic. We're coming up on 34 years.
Wow.
And 15 years ago, I got a call from Tower of Power with
Garibaldi.
With 4 days' notice. Garibaldi had a medical emergency.
Oh, boy.
And his family.
Right.
And Emilio Castillo, the leader of the band, calls me and says, can you cut this gig in 3 days? So what was I going to say? And I had Funk Philharmonic. I've been playing the music, and guys in my band had been in Tower, in and out of Tower, and written for Tower. So I was like, this was like a bucket list gig for me. And it was, I learned so much in those 3 days, because they sent me 3 mini discs of live recordings. I went down to my studio, I wrote out my own little book, and I just
Well, hopefully my students will listen to this. So,
And it was, and then, you know, I went in like, yeah, I can play this music. Going and playing with a band that's been breathing together for 40 years.
Finish each other's sentences musically.
You're coming in there, you have to learn how to breathe with them. It took me 2 or 3 gigs to go, oh, okay.
I think I got it now
because it's another, you play a certain way, all of a sudden you're playing now with a whole different band that's leaning in that direction. It was
subbing's the toughest thing.
Yeah, one of the best, most humbling, ass-kicking experiences of my life. Honored.
Yeah, that leads to one of my questions, actually. I was going to say experience you've learned from the most.
Yeah, that's definitely one of them. The other, you know, when I started playing with the Blues Brothers band, so Blues Brothers, you know, you think of the Blues Brothers, you think of the great Steve Jordan, who, if you talk to Steve now, he's not so thrilled with a lot of the stuff he played on the Blues Brothers stuff, because it was the 80s and there was some things going around in the 80s. Mm. And also, you know, he says it himself that he was playing a little too much. If you go back to the original versions of that music, it's Al Jackson Jr., which is just, you know, is where we all come from. And like they once asked Steve Cropper, Steve, have you ever played with a drum machine? And he said, yeah. And his name was Al Jackson Jr. Because when you listen to Al, a lot of those tracks, there is not one fill. And if it is a fill, it's like a snare hit on 4 with a crash leading in.
Right.
It's not even like he's not even. And so when I first started playing with the Blues Brothers, I kind of went there and I kept it as simple as I could. And then one night, hanging out with Mr. Steve Cropper, who penned all that great music, wrote all that stuff, was a producer at Stax, is responsible for that whole Stax Vault sound, one of the authors of all of that music. You know, we were having a few wines at the hotel after the show, and Steve said, Lee, you know, I got to tell you, you know, I really like the way you play, and I really like the way you make the band feel, and I'm waiting for the but. And he says, but, he says, some of that stuff you're doing with your bass drum foot, he's like, I can't play with that. So I said, Steve, please talk to me. Tell me now what the secret is. And he said, you know, he just wanted
solid,
like 4 on the floor, 1 and 3, as simple as possible. Especially when you're playing in like stadiums and big concerts, it doesn't translate. It doesn't go that much further. All that other, anything other, mm-hmm. other bass right. drum stuff. And he gave me a little philosophy, and ever since I've applied it. And he said, you know, when you go into a new musical situation, you try and find the most simplistic thing that works, and then you build from it or you take away from it.
Right.
He said, the challenge is, find that simplistic thing and then find where to take stuff out and create more space.
Right.
And then his next line was, "There's no money in notes."
Yeah.
Which I, you know, I was so thankful he shared that with me. I really started thinking about that and applying it to my playing. And then I came back off tour with the Blues Brothers, and I still had that in my mindset. And some of the guys that I had been playing with for years and years said, "Lee, you're doing something different. There's something different in your playing." And that's what it was. It was creating, not like space every two beats, okay, I'm creating space. You know, every couple of measures where you pull something out and create that space, and it creates more of a pocket. It makes the notes that you're playing more important.
Well, listening more to what it is that the other musicians are playing and playing appropriately to that.
Well, that, of course, right. You have to play for the music.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah.
Right.
So, learning experiences. And then, you know, I do like big band gigs. Next week I'm playing with the Ed Palermo big band. I'm subbing for Ray Marchico, who's like one of the greatest drummers I know in town. And this is like, you know, this is a book, and it's all reading, and it's all Zappa and Captain Beefheart music. And it is like, I mean, every time I do that gig, I learn.
You can't help but do that with Zappa stuff.
Yeah.
You can listen to Zappa stuff exclusively, and you're still not going to learn it all. I'm a huge Zappa fan. I probably have 50 or 60 of his albums, and that's maybe half.
Right.
What actually exists, you know, but there's always going to be one that you just, I can't listen to Jazz from Hell. I can't make, you know, it's one of those where, for anybody that doesn't know, it was pretty much him exclusively. He played on a synclavier when that was a thing. It was like brand new, and I guess there was some material rolling around in his head that he didn't trust, even the murderer's row of people that normally he had playing for him to actually play, so he had to do it all himself. And well, sometimes you can get a little too far into your own head.
Yeah, well, Frank, you know, that music, was, you know, his, you're talking about Vinny and Terry and, you know, and Wackerman and,
Chester Thompson,
yeah,
just Ainsley,
Ralph Humphries,
Dunbar,
right.
Look, whenever I try to turn anybody on to Zappa, I usually start with apostrophe.
Nice.
You know, because there's a little comedy in there. There's a little. If you just go into, like, the crazy stuff in Odd Times, which
it gets a little
but
much.
But it's too heady for somebody. You need
a little petulant.
You need something.
Petulant frenzy. Right.
Yes.
No, I know.
You need something entry level.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I go back to the even earlier stuff, like the Mothers.
Right.
It's 50 years ago, a week ago, that I saw 1971 Stony Brook. That was the first time I saw Ainsley, and they did like the whole White Fillmore record, and that's where I was just like,
crazy.
Ainsley Dunbar became my hero.
Yeah.
Now, do you know that when Hendrix was in England checking out Mitch Mitchell, he was considering Ainsley Dunbar?
You know, I'd like to say I did. I didn't know that. I knew that they were the same period and everything, playing in the same places.
Can you imagine? Manic Depression with Ainsley Dunbar.
Oh, my
God.
You
know, that groove. Oh, ding, 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 right?
Oh, yeah.
Like Ainsley with that fat grit. Mitch Mitchell was, you know, like Philly Joe chops.
Jones,
you know, that.
Yeah.
But Ainsley had, like, you know, that deeper, you know, almost more elven-y.
He could definitely go more into a samba than.
Right.
You know?
And he sounded like two drummers.
Yeah.
You know?
Crazy. So you've had this incredible career. You've done a lot of traveling.
Where's the wood? Thank you. No, it's been nice. It's, you know, I'm fortunate that I get to do this. I feel blessed that I get to travel the world. I get to play music. I get to play the drums. I have to thank my wife, Yvelle, for her unconditional support and love, and for coming to many of my gigs and videotaping and taking pictures and posting on social media and keeping me working. It's I get to meet people like you and talk about it, you know.
Well, it's so great to have you in here.
Thanks.
Tell me about some places you've been that maybe people would be surprised to know what it was really like when maybe they have like a pre-existing notion as to what the places are like. Obviously, it would have to be overseas because everybody knows the States.
As far as traveling.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's really been nice because I've been like on, you know, all around the world, in Europe, in Asia, in North Africa. We did a gig, the Blues Brothers did. We did a gig. It was a big festival in Morocco. So in the hotel, they had dancers and drummers, and it was really special. And we did our show, and this was like an all night. You know, the festivals go like 24 hours, so our hotel was not that far from the festival, so you could hear the music all night. But what was really interesting, when the music stopped in between acts, you know, everything Morocco, everything was like a 6-8, all that, a lot of the dance music. The music would stop, and I held my recorder outside, and I swear, the crickets in Morocco were like, it was like,
that's probably where it came from.
It was 6-8 crickets in Morocco.
That's crazy.
You know, that
maybe they were talking back.
Yeah. I mean, anywhere else in the world, it's you know, what I've found is music is, you know, it's universal. It's the universal language.
Right.
It brings us all together. Everywhere you go, people they want to do the same thing. They want to take care of their family.
Right.
They want to have a good time. And that's about it, you know?
I can tell you, I can't understand people that say they don't like music. That to me, that doesn't even sound like a human statement. You know?
Yeah, there's something, I don't know if it's in their DNA or it's like a blockage it doesn't get in. I mean, so look, some people, you know, they'll go to a museum and they'll stand in front of, you know, and
right.
What do you see?
Right.
What do you get? It's, you know, people have to, you got to take the blinders off and open up. But, you know, getting to see the world, the other thing that blows me away with the Blues Brothers is the music is 50 plus years old, the original stacks, a lot of the music we play. And you look down at the audience and you'll see 9, 11, 13-year-old kids in a different country singing every lyric.
Right.
I don't know if you see that in the United States. Unfortunately, you know, maybe, you know, I don't go to those kind of shows here, but not for that, not yet.
Yeah.
Right, everyone's on their phone. It's amazing. And of course, you know, over there, anything, they embrace anything American. It's a respected art form. And the other thing, you know, I've done a million gigs all around the tri-state and domestically in the United States, and, you know, weddings and private parties and functions like that.
Mm-hmm.
And where you know, it is what it is. You kind of get treated as a vendor, as the help, go through the kitchen, don't look at the food, don't go near the people. And it is what it is. You know, there's nothing you can do about it.
Right.
When you go overseas, you're respected as an artist.
Right.
And they treat you as such. And it's, you know, it's a big difference.
Art has more value.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we've gotten into a danger zone nowadays with it. I mean, I've discussed this on the podcast before, but I always like to bring it up because the response is always going to be different from person to person. The fact that we're in this digital age, the fact that you can ask a 10-year-old kid, you can ask, at this point, you can ask a 20-something-year-old person, what was the last CD you bought? And they say, somebody might even say, what's a CD?
What's a CD?
At this point.
Or bought.
You know? Right, bought for sure.
Bought,
right. The concept of intellectual property
right.
has gone
yeah.
out the window.
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't, right, it has no value. So then the art has no value.
Right.
You know.
At least that's the perception. And that's a dangerous thing. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why, if you look at the Billboard Hot 100 right now, there might be two songs that even are catchy.
Yeah, and maybe that have musical instruments on it as well. Everything is, you know, it's done in the basement on a computer, and it's not being created by musicians or lyricists. Well, lyricists, a lot of lyrics.
One of my other absolute favorite artists of all time is Prince.
Yeah.
And he was very vocal about that.
Yeah.
You know, I saw him on the Musicology tour back in 04. And he was like, "What? You know, the band's playing." This is when he had Mr. Blackwood back there, right? And he was like, he made an announcement with the first song. They're playing the song, and then he breaks from the song, and everybody else is playing. And he says, "Let me just explain what you're going to hear tonight.
Nice.
These are musicians. We are playing music. There is no lip syncing. There is no everything. This is real, you know." And
yep.
He saw the writing on the wall, you know. There were a few people like that. Zappa was another guy.
Well, Zappa,
you know?
I mean, he started his own label. He got out of the whole
music both of those guys were Warner Brothers people.
Right.
And both of them saw, you know.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of it had to do with they were very prolific writers. And I know that I don't know specifically what Zappa's opposition to Warner Brothers was particularly, but I know Prince's was the fact that he had so much music rattling around in his head, and he would record all of this, and he wanted to come out with an album like every 3 months or whatever, and they were thinking, no, they were thinking from a business standpoint, you're going to saturate your market,
right?
And nobody's going to pay attention. But he says, but you don't understand. This that I just recorded is relevant now. In three months, this means nothing.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
And so he was one of the guys that actually started with the whole digital download thing. And then people took advantage. And then he was like, okay. When he was still alive, try to find any of his stuff online.
Right. Oh, yeah. Right.
You couldn't. Because the minute it went up, a cease and desist letter came out from a lawyer.
Yeah.
And it came right back down again. You know, after he had that NPG... club or whatever it was, and as soon as people abused it and it came down, he got hurt.
Well, for the longest time, I couldn't find Zappa music on YouTube as well. Same thing.
There was good reasons for that,
yeah.
and also one of the newer bands that I like a lot, Tool.
Mm-hmm.
That's a puzzle box. Those songs,
right.
You know, you have to figure them out.
Yeah.
You know, but just something I'm interested in doing. You've been playing for this long.
Yeah.
You are intrigued by things that you can't just immediately, at least, you know, plug you in and play. You might not play it exactly like the guy does.
Right.
But you're at least, you know, passable. You know,
yeah.
With that, you've got to figure out what this thing is.
Right.
You
right.
know?
Yeah.
But a lot of these places, one of the reasons why you haven't seen them as MP3s is because, well, you know, an MP3 is not a perfect format. It gets compressed.
Sound quality,
the sound quality gets destroyed. And with Zappa, there's albums that he had where, like, I know it's on Ship Arriving Too Late to Save a Drowning Witch.
Uh-huh.
On the inside sleeve, he told you what microphones were used. He told you what monitors that they listened to.
Right.
So if you can get your hands on some of these or, like, the equivalent, this is what my music should sound like. So this is a guy that cared that much about the end result of his efforts that he already knew digital was coming when he died, and he rallied against it. And he told Gail, as probably and other people, look, I don't want it on this. But, you know, after a while, and you've been in the ground for as many years as he has, if you want your legacy to continue.
Yeah, it's
you got to get it out there in any way, shape, or form you can. Which is, I don't know if you've
Broadway
seen
Broadway the hard way, or
right,
the only way to go. Right.
Did you ever see Dweezil perform any of his dad's stuff?
Yes, a couple of times. I've become friends with Ryan Brown now.
Right.
Who's got the drum chair? Who's just killing it.
Right.
You know,
right.
Just a couple of times I've seen them. It's been different guys, but the couple of times I've seen them, it's been different guys, but Joe Travers, who was the first drummer with Zappa, plays Zappa, really moved me. what's it, Joe, first guy that went out with Dweezil.
I know who you're talking about because that's about when I saw him.
And he was just, he had the chops of Vinny, but the grease of Bozio.
Right,
was, And Dweezil, I've seen him probably in the past 7 years, has grown as a musician. It's just unbelievable. You know, he has like a camp. You can go to camp and learn how to play Frank Zappa music.
Well, he had to stop.
Yeah. Well,
And learn how his dad played because his dad's not who taught him. Steve Vai pretty much taught
him. Right, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's incredible. Yeah. I missed this last tour. We really wanted to go.
Yeah, what was really interesting, the time that I saw him at the Westbury Music Fair, and they did have it in the round, which means while he's playing, he's looking at the crowd, right? And there was a kid, about 16 years old, right? He's playing air guitar, but he's noticing his fingers are where they would be on the frets while he's doing that. So he actually calls out to him, and he says, do you play guitar? And he goes, yes. This is how long have you been playing? He says, about 6-7 years. He goes, you think you could handle a blues tune in C?
Wow.
And he goes, yeah. And he says, I'm going to have somebody come and get you. And he had this kid come up on stage and play. It was so cool.
That's I love it. That's great. Yeah, like he's an educator.
Yeah, he cares about it.
Yeah.
You know, which is important, you know. But amazing.
Yeah.
Let's see what else. All right, future plans.
Well, I'm going to keep hitting them until they pull them from my cold, dead hands. Pull the sticks from my cold, dead hands. No, it's, at this point, there's really not much else I can do. This is what I do. I'm just going to continue, hopefully, to do more gigs, meet more musicians, play lots of different music, and continue. Like, from here, I'm going over to a recording session. Did one yesterday with a couple of folks I know, and it's always a great experience being in the studio playing some new music.
It is. It definitely keeps you sharp. You know, live is to me that's my heart.
Yeah, well, but, who doesn't love the live, right?
Yeah, but it can be humbling in the studio. You know, you think your time's good.
Oh yeah. Well, once you get under the microscope, it's like, can we do that again?
Yeah,
but now, with Pro Tools and computerized,
quantizing and all this other stuff,
The Pro Tool, the joke, the engineer says, okay, guys, that sucked. Come on in.
Because
we'll fix it in the mix. Look, you nailed the first verse. We're just going to take that first verse and copy it.
I've had guys, you do 2-3 takes of something, and they Frankenstein together a couple of takes.
Okay, we got it.
They like this part of one of them that you did, this one, But that takes, that's a skill in and of itself,
Some of the guys that just, they do it in a second.
Crazy.
And they make you, that's why I always tell engineer, thank you for making me sound good.
Yeah, yeah. Because I don't claim to be the big tech, I know computers and stuff like that, but I learn by necessity. I have no schooling on any of that stuff, so I don't even profess to be able to, most of these buttons on this thing mean literally nothing to me. I had to get rid of a buzzing sound earlier, so I had to pray to God I hit the right button.
No, yesterday, we it was the last pass on this track, and instead of I took the sign, but instead of going to letter B for the sign, I went to letter A, and letter A continued. But letter A was basically the same as letter B. And when I got to where B, where the song should have ended,
second ending kind of thing? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I kept playing. I was like, oh, the song's over. I was like, I messed up. I was like, don't worry about it. And they went back into Pro Tools and, okay, song just, done. You ended there. Thank you.
That's
go
crazy.
Home now.
That's insane.
Right. Yeah.
Wow.
The thing about the Blues Brothers, we did a record 2 years ago, and just for me it was an honor recording with some of my heroes and some of those legends, and being documented with those guys. But we did a old school studio record. The entire band vocals, horns, everything playing at the same time in a big room,
right,
with bleeding into the, and it was just, what an experience. No click track, no, you know, tracking, no sequencers, and it was just,
but you just catch, was, you catch magic.
It was a little scary because by today's standards, everyone's listening with a metronome. It's like, oh, it's not perfect time, and it just,
but that's
the
human.
Band was so strong.
Yeah,
it
yeah.
just it came out so great, and the important thing was it really captured the live essence of that band.
Yes,
and I got to record with some here, Dr. John. Before he passed,
yeah.
Matt Guitar Murphy.
Well, we've taken a lot of hits over the last couple of years, haven't we?
Yeah, well, that's, you know, it's...
It's the nature of things,
yeah,
you know,
it's,
but...
It's inevitable. It's going to happen. Thankfully, we have the music and the legacy forever.
Yes.
You know?
That's
Don't ever forget that stuff.
I have a list in my head. There's a time in your life where you realize... that your days are in fact numbered. You're not an immortal. And there is, and if you're an artist, there are people that exist that have their material now for the archives available forever, that it's okay that you can slip this mortal coil because the next generation will still have these things.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Yeah. Guys like Stevie Wonder, you know, just the things,
right,
that,
that's what they keep saying, wrap them in bubble wrap.
Yeah, right? Prince, you know, when he's, you know, when you're that prolific, not everything's going to hit, right? But the stuff that hit,
yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Well, Stevie just, it's
like,
just so special.
Like Sting called him a higher being.
Well, he is.
You know?
Yeah. That's what they say, but, you know, you want to hear what God's voice sounds like? Listen to Stevie Wonder sing. Yeah.
Unbelievable. It's another guy I'd love to meet one day.
Yeah.
You know, so. I guess a last question would be, cool people you've met that everybody would know. I mean, obviously, playing with the Blues Brothers. Who's the current lineup of the Blues Brothers now?
The current Blues Brothers lineup, Steve the Colonel Cropper, Blue Lou Marini, John Smokin' John Trope, Leon Pendarvis is our musical director. New guy James Haggerty is playing bass. On horns, there's Larry Farrell and Birch Johnson on trombone and Steve Howard on trumpet. And our three front men is Bobby Sweet Soul Harden, Rob the Honey Dripper Paparozzi, and Tommy Pipes McDonald. We all have our blues handle. When I got the gig, they gave me the handle Funky Time, so I'm known as Lee Funky Time Finkelstein.
To go back, first concert I ever saw out here on Long Island, we went to see Steppenwolf, me and my friend Bruce.
Wow.
And who opened for Steppenwolf was Booker T and the MGs, which is Steve Cropper.
Wow.
So my first tour on the bus, I'm sitting on the bus next to the guy who played at the first concert I ever went to.
Right.
One of the other early concerts I went to was the John Trope. No, it was Diodato who did that remake of 2001, The Space Odyssey.
Right.
And John Trope has that famous guitar solo. So I saw John Trope at Westbury Music Fair in like 72 or 73 with Diodato. And he's on the other side. I'm sitting on the bus with two guys that I grew up listening to.
Right.
So that's just, you know, that's just special. So the lineup, yeah. And there's, we have three guys that front the band now that put on the hat and glasses and do the Aykroyd and Belushi thing, and that's Rob Paparozzi, Tommy McDonald, and Bobby Harden. The bass player is he's in the newest member. His name is James Haggerty, originally from Hopog, Long Island.
Wow.
But he's he's been in Nashville about 25 years. And on trumpet is Steve Howard. And as of late, Birch Johnson is back on trombone with us. And I did mention Blue Lou Marini.
Yes.
Who's kind of the leader of the band. I like to call him my boss, you know, which just so funny.
That's
King Tut, on Saturday Night Live, if you remember that.
Yes,
it's
I do.
Lou Marini. And, you know, I'm doing the gig now 15 years. So, you know, I'm in that quote-unquote, I'm in the club.
Right.
They're friends of mine. They're buddies. Right. They're brothers. The camaraderie on the road is priceless. There's no nonsense. There's no silliness. Wow. It's just we go and we, it's like a freight train. The band kills. And it's just, it's an honor. It's
how
honor and a privilege.
Special and rare that is.
Totally.
Yeah, amazing. Well, I could sit and talk to you for another hour, but
yeah,
we're going to run out of time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So
let's just make this a standing invite to come back.
I'd love to come back. I mean, we talk more drums and more technical, but
this was really
nice.
I really wanted to get this out first, you know, and if I have anybody come back, the plan is to switch this over to a little bit expanded, maybe have a video element to it.
Great.
And
you got the studio, man.
Yeah, well, you know, I gotta
this
run
place
some
down
more
here.
Tech.
It's great.
Yeah.
And just a little plug, if I might.
Go ahead.
The Funk Philharmonic you mentioned, we're celebrating our 34th anniversary. And that was a band that started just a bunch of guys that wanted to play Tower Power and Earth, Wind & Fire, horn-generated music. We started 34 years ago and never looked back. We have our 34th anniversary coming up out here at the Warehouse in Amityville. Monday, December 2nd. Really looking forward to just being in the room with my 11 brothers because that's a special love. It's priceless.
That's great. That's great.
Andrew, it's great to meet you in person. We've been,
back and forth
in touch
a little
online.
Bit,
I'm glad we finally got this together.
We associated a little bit at the Drum Center years ago, but I don't think we really didn't know each other at all.
This is great,
but,
man. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This has been D's Practice Pod, and we'll talk to you guys real soon.
Ciao.